Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, first, area municipalities were unified in their opposition to the I-77 toll lanes.
Mecklenburg County's statement is clear that our original vote was no.
But sentiment is shifting as calls come to reconsider, and so Mecklenburg County will do just that.
This will come back on the agenda in September for a vote.
Why the sands are shifting, we'll talk about that. Teen takeovers are raising concerns, with CMPD Chief Estella Patterson recommending a change in curfews for those under 18.
If we don't get a handle on this, the consequences may become fatal.
City Council is considering that change. CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill remains under investigation for unknown reasons. What is known is that she may get a raise while she is on paid leave. And Cyclospora is spreading around the country. It's here in North Carolina with over 300 known cases. Here to fill us in on those stories and more is Ashley Faye, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Mary C. Curtis joins us. She is a columnist for rollcall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
Okay, let's go. It looked like I-77 toll lanes from uptown to South Carolina were a done deal. The planning had been done, but then the public saw the plan. They didn't like it, so in May, the plan was killed. Then the threats began, and now it seems we may be on a different path toward a different decision. First, talk about how we got here, Eric. It's highly unusual for a project like this to be killed after it's been designed. How were citizens able to change the minds of policymakers in these various municipalities that make up the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization?
Well, the biggest change for politicians who ultimately killed this came in the form of a backlash that started in the fall when the initial designs of the I-77 toll lanes were first released. This has been talked about for 20 years, but the first designs did not come out until late last year. That backlash then led to the CRTPO. There are all kinds of horrible acronyms when we talk about transportation. This regional transportation body voted in May to kill the project, as you said. Okay, but what do we do next?
But they're very, that's unusual.
That's very unusual. Yes.
Most of the time, developers and planners win. Why didn't they win this time? What was it about the pushback?
I think the pushback, particularly from the Black Political Caucus, who took a very strong stance with members of City Council, a litmus test, and you have a lot of members of council who are looking at a mayoral run in 2027. I think that had a big impact. And I think that the neighborhood groups on the west side were very effective in their tactics in turning out to council meetings and really making clear how opposed to this they were. And the third factor, Mike, I would cite is that NCDOT, the Department of Transportation, was quite clumsy in its response and in building trust with the neighborhood groups.
But if it were just Charlotte making this decision, it would be understandable that the West Side would have such heft in this decision. But it's 27 members representing Matthews, Mint Hill, Huntersville, Davidson, Cornelius, and Monroe, among others. A two-thirds vote by the CRTPO, I can't talk this morning, I'm sorry, killed the $4.3 billion project. But that may not be the end of this, because almost immediately we were warned that we, these municipalities that said no, may have to pay back the money already spent on design, something between $60 and $64 million. I keep seeing different figures. And then Mecklenburg-Iredell State Senator Vicki Sawyer found a way to include that in the recently passed budget bill. Ashley, is that what is driving this? Is that really the crux of this reversal, this potential reversal?
I would say yes. I mean, already the councils in Cornelius and Monroe have voted to reverse their opposition to the I-77 toll lanes. And of course, at the CARTPO meeting this week, we know that this is going to come up again in September at their meeting. I think it's September 23rd. I do think this is the main driving factor for the vote to come up. And I think the big factor here is how Charlotte City Council, whether or not they change their stance on it, because of course they carry 42% of the vote on CARTPO. So I think there's a, you know, there's a 90-day deadline here that was given in the budget bill. So I think that puts us to about October 5th, early October, for the CARTPO to make a decision on this.
CARTPO is the other acronym for CRTPO, the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization. But Cornelius and Monroe, I believe I'm correct in saying this, pulled out. They reversed their decision before the budget bill passed. Why?
Because they were worried about that budget bill passing and being partly responsible for repaying the money. And Mike, we could drag this out forever. We won't. But there is a major dispute about whether this is constitutional for the state to impose this type of penalty or repayment, and also whether the $60 million or $64 million figure is accurate and what the share is of each community. So there are endless threads to this story if it is not reversed.
There's also other things other than paying back the $60 million that's at risk here. I understand that the $600 million in state funding may be at risk, as well as the funding of other unrelated projects. Is that correct?
That's correct. The $600 million was approved to help pay for the $4.3 billion project. The rest of it would be paid for by private developers who would recoup the money through charging tolls to commuters. So if that goes away, the $600 million instantly disappears, as does that $100 million bonus that comes with approving a toll road.
So the language in the bill that threatens to make us pay this money back gives CRTPO, CARTPO members 90 days to reverse course to avoid having to repay these upfront expenses. But there is a question, as you say, whether this is constitutional, whether it's legal. And Governor Josh Stein is in charge of the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Some believe he could stop any moves they might be making to get the money back. So why aren't area municipalities willing to wait to see what happens?
I think that when you look at smaller governments in particular, the money, the ratio of that money comparatively, it's big enough that it scares them to a much greater degree than, let's say, Charlotte has to pay back $40 million. $40 million out of a $4 billion budget's not that much.
I mentioned all these municipalities that are part of this CRTPO: Matthews, Mid-Hill, Huntersville, Davidson, Cornelius, Monroe, Charlotte, of course, and Mecklenburg County is also a member. Commissioner Arthur Griffin was clear about the county's position being no until it isn't.
Mecklenburg County's statement is clear that our original vote was no, and it remains the same at this point until such time there's additional information that would cause that board to change. So certainly we'll bring that back to the board. And what your information is tonight is that this will come back on the agenda in September for a vote.
So is a similar vote scheduled in Charlotte or in Cornelius or Davidson or Huntersville?
Well, anybody? The first two that you mentioned have already voted. Those town councils have voted and directed their representatives to say, we don't want to do this. Okay. Council and Mecklenburg County, it looks pretty likely that they will have a vote or some kind of extended conversation before that September 23rd meeting. Although Mecklenburg County really doesn't matter. They only have three votes. This is all about Charlotte City Council and what Edriggs ultimately decides to vote in
well,
September.
Well, Edriggs has said he's not only on City Council, he's a member of the CRTPO, and he says he will vote the way City Council tells him to vote. But as you pointed out, Ashley, Charlotte has 42%. Their vote is weighted. They have 42% of the votes on this organization. So ultimately, we would be paying the most if we have to pay anything. Will we also ultimately be the decision maker in this?
I mean, I would say yes. And I think it's a very interesting time, just given Eric's point earlier, there's so much pressure from the Black Political Caucus of Mecklenburg County, Charlotte-Mecklenburg, as far as who they're going to support in the mayoral race. And they have come out very much against the toll lanes. And in fact, the whole reason why this rescission started was, I think, because of that. But then the Charlotte Regional Business Alliance has been kind of on the other side, saying we need to get these toll lanes through and we need this project to go forth. So I'll be very interested to see kind of how these council conversations go and if there is a change of heart.
What has our new mayor had to say about this?
Well, that's what I was about to say. It's going to be really intriguing to learn how the new mayor, Rob Harrington, feels about it, because we've all asked him and he has, in a very legalistic, careful way, said that it's an important issue. Everyone needs to speak and have input in this, and to be determined how he really feels about it.
Welcome to the job, Mayor Harris.
Yep. So if this vote is reversed, is it too late to make design changes that might fix some of the objections that we had? No, it's not too late.
It's not. Now, this is really an interesting part of this whole conversation. NCDOT said consistently, this is true, that design is 10 to 15% complete. They can still make changes and improvements. Well, yes and no. They can make changes around the edges, but it's still a double-decker interstate that's going to go over Uptown, and people don't like that, and that's not going to change. And it's still going to be much wider, encroaching on neighborhoods along the way on the first half of it. So I guess that's one that's in the eye of the beholder.
Wow. Okay, well, stay tuned because the votes are coming. Quick and fast and furious. We spent an hour yesterday talking about a phenomenon that is happening all over the country, teen takeovers, where hundreds, even thousands of young people under the age of 18 converge on a particular area at a particular time. Sometimes these gatherings are peaceful, just fun events. Other times they have erupted into violence, gunfire, and the destruction of property.
While teens gathering on its face isn't or should not be an issue, what happens is that these teen takeovers frequently result in disorderly conduct, public affrays, assaults, impeding traffic if they go into the streets, or other violent crimes.
CMPD Deputy Chief Jacqueline Brierley at this week's meeting of Charlotte City Council's Safety Committee, where this was discussed. How many of these events has Charlotte proper and the surrounding area experienced in the last 12 months? Do we know? Is there a count?
I don't know about a count, but there's been several high profile ones. Romare Bearden Park in June, Camp North End has seen a couple, Burkdale Village, that one kind of made headlines earlier this year. I guess it just depends on the scope that we're talking about here, but there was one on I-77, I think, maybe late last year or early this year. I can think of at least half a dozen that really were kind of higher profile, but maybe there were more as well.
And how many of them have involved violence, property destruction, or gunfire?
That's a good question. The only one I know for sure, Robert Bearden, I think there was 2 dozen arrests and there was a firearm
seized, right?
Confiscation of a firearm. Yeah. And I think 13 parents were cited in that, but I don't think these are all exactly the same. I think some of the concern is just it disrupts traffic. In other places, it has gotten violent. There's been some teen takeovers in Raleigh that have gotten violent. So maybe the concern is more, could these escalate?
Yeah, there was a teen takeover in Raleigh in which 5,000 to 8,000 young people gathered at one time and within a one block area. And in just a couple of hours, there were 3 shootings. It is the possibility of violence that concerns CMPD Chief Estella Patterson. And that is why she proposed a change in Charlotte's Youth Protection Ordinance. It already calls for curfews for those under 15 after 11 p.m. And Patterson wants that changed.
I firmly believe that a change in the curfew time will help keep our youth safe and will add to the successes that we have seen in working with our youth population.
So I have 15 seconds. What is she proposing?
9 p.m. curfew instead of the 10 and 11 p.m. curfews that exist for various ages of children.
Okay.
We're going to come 18, back.
Right? We're gonna, under 18.
Yes, under 18. We're going to come back and talk about we're going to come back and talk about why that seems to be the way to go, if it is in fact the way to go, and more in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte, celebrating 95 years of impact in the Carolinas, strengthening nonprofits, neighborhoods, and people through the support of charitable contributions. More at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Ashley Fahey joins us. She's managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, and Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. We were talking about the call for changing the age of curfews by CMPD Chief Estella Patterson. Right now, the curfew is for ages 13 to 15, and I believe the time is 11 p.m. to 6 a.m., and Patterson believes raising the age to 18 will make this easier to enforce. It's challenging now because younger teens, think about this, do not carry IDs that have their birth date or their age on them because they don't have driver's licenses. So right now, it will be difficult to arrest those who might be violating the current curfew, but not if you raise the age to 18.
When you have a crowd of 200-300, we're not going to be able to arrest everyone. But in that crowd, the majority are underage kind of thing. We're able to maybe make 10 arrests, juvenile arrests, and contact parents and such. But the majority of those individuals, we firmly believe, are in violation of the curfew.
But Deputy Chief Bradley says offenders would be given a warning before moving to tickets or arrests or citations.
And this is where we really enforce education and compliance prior to any type of enforcement taking place.
The chair of the City Council Safety Committee, Dante Anderson, says this is not about punishing young people. It is about protecting them. And Council's Dimple Ajmera echoed that sentiment.
This discussion is not about punishing our youth. It's to really make sure that we are educating first.
So what does that mean? How does this proposal educate anyone?
Well, it tells them not to be on the street.
Yeah. And stay out of trouble.
This brings up so many issues because people immediately said, well, you have kids that are home. You have many whose parents are working many jobs. It is very hot in the summer. Not everybody has a rec room or a computer or air conditioning, and kids want to be out there. And if you're going to have to supply things for them to do, and we see that so many federal programs that had midnight basketball and so forth have been eliminated. So they announced they're having these teen summer jams that will be places that the kids can go. Because, you know, now, particularly with social media, somebody says something going on, let's all go out there. And most of the kids just want to be out and with people and with friends. So you have to actually supply an alternative. And as I said, I think life circumstances, for many of the people who are saying, why aren't they home? Where are the parents? Well, people have different life circumstances. And you have the approach of someone like the mayor of Baltimore, my hometown, Brandon Scott, they've really early on identify people who are going to be maybe victims or perpetrators of crime and do interventions very early on to give them things to do, to give them jobs. So it seems simpler just to say, okay, 9 o'clock, under 18, but it's a lot more complicated than that.
This free and easy summertime that young people can experience, because we all did when we were young, is why I want to bring James Farrell into this discussion. He's WFAE's education reporter. He'll be with us for this topic and a few others. Chief Patterson believes, James, that it is freedom from school, her words, that drives these takeovers. But the council's next meeting isn't until August the 10th, and by the time they discuss and vote on this, kids will be back in school. So do schools have a role that they can play in this in the interim?
Yeah, I think that's definitely kind of something that's a little out of sync with this, is that if that is the problem and kids being free from school is playing a role into this, then that kind of coming up close to the first day of school then kind of poses challenges with that. But I absolutely think schools play a huge role in this. I think we've seen time and time again the way that schools function is more than just places of education and academics. They're kind of community centers. Kids rely on them for things like meals, for after school programs, like kind of like what Mary was talking about there, things to do that are outside of school. And during the summer, we don't have that kind of regularity, those kinds of places that are available to kids. Once we get into the school year, you feel this need for kind of these third places that aren't home or school that kids can go to hang out and have fun that doesn't become disruptive or dangerous like that.
Well, we talked about this yesterday. We did a whole hour on this yesterday, and one of our guests was Dr. Susan McCarter from the School of Social Work at UNC Charlotte, and she, too, stressed the need for third places. We all have that need. For adults, it's home, that's first place, work is second, someplace else, a coffee shop, a shopping mall, a bar is, for adults, their third place. For kids, school is second place. It's home, school, third place. It, can school be second and third?
I think in some cases it can be. When schools have robust after-school programming, sometimes there's not funding for that. That can create challenges. I think that a risk that we see when there's no third place is that a third place might become something like social media, where you can see these kinds of gatherings really build up and become something, you know, more dangerous. And to go back to schools for a second, I think for this generation of teens especially, these are kids that are coming out of the pandemic, where they were on their phones, they were in front of screens, they were not learning in classrooms for a period of time, they weren't with and around their friends. So I think there's a higher demand too for this too. And I think that highlights the roles that schools can play in helping to give kids things to do and have them have FaceTime with each other and kind of eliminate the need for these kind of more crazy gatherings.
Mary.
And I think you also, I do think you have to pair it with the fact of, do the society want to commit to them? Do communities want to put in the investment? Because we've seen how schools have shrunken when it comes to things like sports activities, cultural activities, schools that have musical programs. And oftentimes, legislators say, well, just teach them the basics. But these things are essential. And oftentimes these happen after school, and they give the kids another interest. So we have to realize, how do we want to just go to the punishment end, or do we want to give them these third spaces and also these activities that will engage them, and that's also a part of their education?
And that was the quote, education. It's about education.
James.
Yeah, and then just to add to what Mary was saying there too, I mean, whenever we see budget crunches, which happen a lot in North Carolina schools, it's those activities that are the first to go, extracurricular activities, sports, music, things like that. So that contributes to that as well, I think.
I don't know that summertime is the only time that these things happen, because I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, the Birkdale Village incident was not in the summertime. It was chillier, or at least not summer. One of the third places that young people have used have been shopping malls. And more shopping malls are putting their own curfews in place because they don't want hordes of teenagers traipsing through their malls. Are there enough options? Are people talking about this? Are schools talking about this, James, of coming up with new and better ideas and things to do in the summertime?
I think, unfortunately for schools, a lot of times it's kind of more about how do we keep classrooms staffed with qualified teachers that sometimes, because of the limited resources, that becomes the focus of the conversation. So I do think sometimes this conversation can get a little lost in terms of trying to find those activities. I think obviously Mary touched on before the teen summer jams. I think that that's kind of an interesting alternative. Is there a way that we can do more of that, create things like that, partnerships with schools? You know, I think that conversation still has to be had much more robustly, though.
James, stick around, because I'm going to bring you back into this conversation when we talk about some other school-related activities. But this call for changing our curfew policy was just a portion of CMPD's mid-year safety report, in which police say crime is down in multiple categories across the city. The only thing edging higher was homicides. What else do we know about that report, Eric?
Yeah, there was a lot of good news. As you said, homicides up was the bad news. 40 through the first half of this year compared to 39 in 2025. But other than that, almost everything was down. I think 16% decrease in overall crime, 8% down in violent crime. And then you look at all the subcategories: assault, rape, robbery, property crime, residential burglary, commercial burglary, car thefts. All of those were down, many of them by double digits. And the police say it's a combination of a higher visibility, more presence, closer work with the community. And so they were very optimistic. And you've mentioned Chief Patterson a few times. Remember, she is, you know, pretty new on the job. Right. And she has earned glowing reviews, particularly in business circles. I hear all the time how happy people are with the way that she is approaching her job, and these numbers certainly add to that.
That was my next question, because Chief Patterson credits the improvements that we're talking about here this morning to proactive policing, increased officer visibility, and community partnerships. How many of those things were taking place before she got here, or are all of these because she is here, something new that she's put into place?
Well, that's a good question. You know, we have talked about this over and over. The police are always talking about a higher visibility, working with, I mean, I think those are fundamentals of every police department across the country. I think that not covering the police department closely enough, I couldn't go policy by policy. Okay. I will say, I think that Chief Patterson clearly has made a difference in morale on the force. And I think she has definitely made a mark with confidence from the surrounding community. And I think those two things are very important.
So, Mary, as we all know, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham died unexpectedly last Saturday night. And this week, that state's governor, Henry McMaster, wasted no time in announcing his choice for the person to fill out Lindsey Graham's term. Senator Graham's sister, Darlene, she was also Donald Trump's choice. Is this more of an honorific, or does she bring qualifications with her to the Senate?
Well, I think this a lot was to honor Lindsey Graham. I don't believe she is going to run for his spot. I mean, there's already Republicans eyeing the run, including Lieutenant Governor Pamela Abbott and Representatives Nancy Mace. She's always there, Ralph Norman, Russell Fry. But this is someone, you know, when she was a teenager, she was adopted by Lindsey Graham when their parents died. She's been there every step of the way, very close. Donald Trump, as you said, weighed in because Lindsey Graham went from being a harsh critic to one of his greatest supporters. So he is really looking at this race. And I just think that, you know, everybody showed up and that this is a great honor for her. Yeah. But of course, he was going to run for re-election. So we're going to see next month a special election to try to get someone to replace him.
And do we know what her positions on issues are? Or can we assume that they are very similar, if not identical, to Senator Lindsey Graham?
I have not talked to her. I do not know her, and she's been in the background, but I do believe that she would be with her brother on pretty much everything because she is just devoted to him.
And so she becomes South Carolina's first female senator.
Yes.
Has her appointment broken whatever glass ceiling there may or may not have been for women candidates in the Palmetto State? In other words, does her presence in the Senate now, whether she runs again or not, make it easier for somebody like Nancy Mace to run successfully on the GOP ticket, or for Annie Andrews to be successful on the Democratic side, because she is the Democratic nominee?
I'm not sure that she will be seen because of how she got the position as much of a trailblazer in the sense that she wasn't on the campaign trail, and nobody's going to really push against her or anything like that. They know she's pretty much a placeholder, but we will see. I think that the Democrat really starts from below in a very red state in South Carolina, but they'll use this because the Republican who runs is going to have a much shorter window to campaign. So we'll see what happens.
And we don't know for certain that she's a placeholder, because we have seen instances where wives have taken over for their deceased husbands who are members of the Senate and then go on to have long careers in the United States Senate.
You are right there. Yes. Even we've seen that with mayors of Charlotte who say they weren't going to appoint it.
Let me bring James Farrell back into our conversation. He's WFAE's education reporter. CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill remains on suspension with pay while the school board continues an investigation. We know nothing. We have known nothing about this investigation, at least up until this point. Do we know anything more this week than we did last week about why they are investigating her?
No, not officially, at least. We haven't heard any word as to the status of the investigation, the focus of the investigation. All we know is that same thing they said at the beginning, that it has something to do with, quote, administrative and operational oversight. Sounded like it was more general than maybe just one specific thing. It has been 1 month officially today since they placed her on leave, so we're still waiting. We were told at the time it would be several weeks, which really could mean anything. I was told by CMS yesterday that the board is expecting an update on the investigation in the next few weeks, but that's not anything specific. So,
Crystal
so in
Hill,
short, no.
Crystal Hill has said that she was in the dark about this. Is she still?
She has not put out any comments since that last comment where she's still in the dark. So we don't know the status of what she knows and doesn't know at this point, but have not heard from her since that original comment.
So it came to light this week that while Crystal Hill is on suspension with pay, she is scheduled to get a raise. In December, the school board, the very same one that is now investigating her, approved an extension to her contract, which called for her to receive that raise. From what to what? How much?
It's about a $22,000 increase, or 7%, from $318,000 to $340,000. And Mike, to your point, I think that's one of the things that has made this so interesting, is that we're just months away from the school board passing this raise. It's just months ago that they passed this raise and this contract extension, and now we're in the middle of this investigation where her job status is very much in question. So it's been a really interesting kind of whiplash that we've seen over the last school year.
As Eric will tell you, this is not the first time that this has happened at various different levels of Charlotte-Mecklenburg government. Why does this keep happening, where people are lauded and given raises and bonuses and contract extensions, and then 20 minutes later they're fired? Why is this happening?
No one has given, Mike, you're right. It happens over and over again. No one's given a good answer for this in any of these examples. Maybe we'll have history this time, make history this time, but we haven't heard it in the past.
So the terms of the contract call for the raise to become effective when the state approves the pay raise for teachers. Well, they just did that. So will this be retroactive to the December date on which her contract was extended?
Yes, I believe
because
it's
teacher raises are not retroactive.
That is true. Yeah, teacher. There is no back pay for teachers in this, but I do believe the contract was structured so that she would get back pay, I think, to December 1st, if I'm remembering correctly. So a few months of back pay there for sure.
So this is a large school system, and so running it is no small job. I don't want to minimize that in any way. And she will make in 2 months with this new raise what starting teachers make in a year. And as you pointed out, her raise amounts to 7%. How does that compare to the percentage of raises that the teachers will get when you add in the supplement?
Well, yeah, it's depends on how long you've been working for. We know that the way that the state budget structured this pay scale is that newer teachers are seeing a bigger raise in their base pay of about 17%. And then more veteran teachers are seeing a more modest raise of about 5%. And of course, one of the big criticisms there is that those teachers don't see increases, step increases in the pay scale from year 15 to 25. So depending on where you are in the pay scale, that it kind of compares to Dr. Hill's raise in that way. If you're an earlier teacher, you're seeing a bigger raise percentage-wise, and versus if you're more veteran, you're seeing a smaller raise percentage-wise.
So I have 20 seconds left. This investigation, if it results in her being released, will she keep that extra money? Will the increase of that guarantee payout have any impact on what they have to pay her out if she leaves? I have 10 seconds.
I'm not sure off the top of my head. I'd have to look at the contract again. I don't know.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to switch our attention to schools in Gaston County. Stay with us at Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Ashley Fahey is here, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte, Ashley Fahey, managing editor of the Charlotte Ledger. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. All these managing editors floating around. Don't you have jobs? Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for rollcall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. And James Farrell is with us for a moment or two more. He is our education reporter here at WFAE. Over in Gaston County, James, their school system's money problems seem to be continuing. This week, Gaston County commissioners voted to provide an additional $5 million to the system, and that's just weeks after approving a flat budget to the system. Why did they revisit this funding decision?
Yeah, this has been a very interesting saga because they, like you mentioned, they passed this flat budget earlier this spring. But at the time, they had kind of made this promise that they were going to work with school leaders to try to find more funding. The school district had been very clear that they felt that the flat budget would not help them keep up their operations. They would need to do some layoffs. They've already done some layoffs. So there had been kind of these joint meetings between members of the county commission and members of the school board. These meetings at first were not open to the public. They allowed two members of the public in to watch a couple of the meetings. At some point, it was a very strange kind of situation where they were trying to come up with the needs for the school district and come to some sort of compromise about funding that they could provide. We know now that those meetings yielded what they called an $11.3 million wish list for the school, and the county commissioners ultimately decided to fund about $5 million of that, mostly focused on teacher salary supplements, the helping locally funded employees get the state raises, and also keeping one of their schools open, the WB Beam Intermediate School, which had been at threat of closing.
So Gaston County School Superintendent Morgan Houchard had warned that this flat budget that the county approved recently would have led to 75 job cuts. That would be on top of the 243 school-level positions and the 47 central office positions they cut in the last several years. How much of a role did that play in this decision to kick in more money?
Oh, I think it played a huge role. I mean, we also had this $10 million bailout that the county had to give in the middle of the year. There had been this unexpected budget shortfall, and the county gave $10 million more in the middle of the school year, in the middle of the budget cycle, in order to kind of shore up and make sure there weren't even more layoffs. So I think that played a big role. I think even a bigger role has been the resident pushback in Gaston County. Residents have been showing up big, pushing for more funding for schools, trying to make sure that teachers are not getting laid off or anything like that. I think that played a big role too. There was a lot of pressure to try to make sure schools were adequately funded. From what I'm seeing, I don't know that this $5 million is going to allay all of those concerns, because it didn't meet that whole wish list that Gaston County schools had presented. But certainly I think it played a role in them doing anything more than what they had passed in the budget.
But commissioners say one thing it did was this teacher pay raise or pay match amounts to the largest supplement increase in Gaston County's history. It passed on a 4-3 vote. And Gaston County Vice Chair Bob Hovis says the county agrees that the school needs more schools need more money, but right now he's concerned about pulling too much money from the county fund balance to fill that need.
The question is how far we want to go in our savings account to manage the county properly so that we don't find ourselves in a situation, unintended as it was, that the school system found themselves.
So you have this situation last year where Gaston County had to give more money to schools in the mid-budget cycle. They pass a flat budget going forward. That's not enough. They vote again to give $5 million more. Why does this keep happening?
I think that if you speak to a lot of residents in Gaston County, there's an argument that Gaston County schools has been historically underfunded. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I think that it typically kind of lags behind its neighbors in terms of the local funding that goes toward it. So that, I think that has been part of it. But I also think that there's a broader conversation about state funding too, and it's a problem. I mean, this whole spring, every budget cycle that we followed, it felt like there was tension, whether it was within the school board, whether it was between the school board and the county. We saw issues in Cabarrus County schools, at CMS, obviously. And I think that all points to sort of the broader funding landscape for schools in North Carolina, where there has been this concern about a lack of state funding as well.
So staying in Gaston County for a moment, a former teacher allegedly fired over a comment that she posted on her personal Facebook page, which she believed was private, about Charlie Kirk's murder, is now suing the Gaston County school system. Among her demands, she wants to be reinstated to her job. What else is she seeking?
I believe she was looking for some monetary payout too, but I don't remember that off the top of my head, Mike. I'm sorry.
What did she say about Charlie Kirk that got her in hot water?
Yeah, she made a comment on a post about Charlie Kirk that referenced that quote that went around after his death about gun violence and something along the lines of that, if you expect a certain amount of gun violence in order for the price of having the Second Amendment right. And that went around and a lot of people made comments on that. And she made a comment that was to the effect of, I can't believe people are mourning this person. She used a much less kind word than I did in the post. But that obviously then went viral, as many of these cases did at that time. This was a really divisive period where these kinds of comments were catching a lot of attention and a lot of national attention from Kirk supporters and critics and things like that. And it kind of just got swept up into all that. It was another example of that.
Mary.
We've seen a lot of these people sue and actually get a settlement, whether they were academics or worked for certain companies, because many of them were fired or let go because of, now this person made a comment, but they basically quoted some of the things that Charlie Kirk had said about not just gun violence, but about women, about Black people, about a whole lot of things. So, and you know, a lot of folks who railed against cancel culture wanted to cancel them out pretty quickly. So we'll see what happens here in North Carolina, but we do know nationally that many people have gotten monetary settlements and some have even been reinstated.
People in broadcasting have known forever that you can't say certain things. You just can't on the air, whether you're a news person and you're supposed to keep your opinions to yourself or whether you're just a person on the radio doing a morning zoo show. There's some things that you can't say. And people who suddenly have access to essentially personal broadcasts through Facebook and Twitter and all these other social media platforms, I don't think really understand that. They think what they're saying is going over the backyard fence and it stops there, but it doesn't stop there. So is this a free speech issue? Can you say anything you want on social media and be immune from any consequences at your job? Has that been decided anywhere?
Well, there's freedom of speech, which means you won't be constitutionally, won't be arrested for these things, but there is not freedom of speech without consequence. And so that's what should the consequences be? What should the limits be? We're still debating that because like you say, it's a whole new world.
James.
And yeah, Mike, I think that the question that you're asking is the exact question that a lot of school districts and university systems were asking as this was playing out in real time. And this lawsuit is an example of that. But we saw that here at CMS, too. There was the Audrey Kell Spirit Rock. And this was kind of on the other side of the issue where a student painted a message that was more supportive of Charlie Kirk on the Spirit Rock and then was later disciplined for it. And then they sued and got a settlement. So clearly schools were acting a little, I think, maybe reactionary, trying to figure out what was going on as these comments were being made. And the backlash was coming swiftly. And, you know, it's led to these kinds of more legal issues now that we're trying to parse out in the courts.
But schools
James
are totally
Farrell.
Different, particularly high schools, because, you know, a lot of students said, well, what some students support, they're offensive to other students. So they have a whole different landscape.
James Farrell is WFAE's education reporter. Thank you for joining us this morning. I appreciate it, James.
Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis was very hard on former Attorney General Pam Bondi when she came before the committee prior to her being fired. He also seemed to have problems with her potential replacement, Todd Blanche, who is serving in that position at least temporarily. But when Blanche, the president's former personal criminal attorney, and there's a mouthful, came before that committee this week, Tillis moderated his tone. Mary, why?
Oh, yes, he did. Well, you know, he is on the Judiciary Committee. If he votes not to send it forward, or if you're on John Cornyn of Texas, that Trump is also against and has kicked out of his primary, if either vote not to, it will not go to the full Senate. But I think that Tillis has said he would, because he started off his talk basically talking about Democrats and talking about their pardons of Hunter Biden and all of these things. And he kind of went a little light on some things, even when it came to the pardons of all the people from January 6th that he had been so tough on. He kind of, you know, said, well, some were just stupid. And the people that, you know, they made stupid mistakes. They weren't like the people who attack police officers. So we see Tillis, as usual, even though he is a lame duck and has nothing to lose, will probably, I would guess, I don't know, vote to put it forward. But we see Blanche, you know, Blanche was asked, did he know Trump? And he said, I'm his lawyer, before he caught himself and said, I was his lawyer.
Yeah.
So, you know, he has said, made it clear there's no separation between the executive branch and his job as attorney general. And he's got,
yeah, he made that very clear. He said that as attorney general, he's a member of the president's cabinet, which is true.
Yes.
But the Justice Department has traditionally been on its
independent.
I want to talk about two of the things you just brought up. On CNN, Senator Tillis spoke about the $1.776 billion compensation slush fund that Donald Trump requested for those arrested as a result of January 6th activities. Blanche initially supported that idea, but Tillis has been critical of it.
It was a bad idea to begin with. I think I referred to it as stupid on stilts. Now it even looks like judges agree with me. We need to get it off the books so that you all won't be asking that question, and my colleagues who are up for re-election in November won't be able to have to try and gloss over something that is fundamentally bad policy, unsustainable, and needs to be put back in a bottle.
So he asked Blanche if that fund had been killed. What response did he get?
Well, Blanche said the point is moot. You won't see it, but it still seems like the stake hasn't been put in its heart. But somehow it could come up in some form or other, because Blanche really was very slick in dancing around all the questions he was asked. So yes, it's dead, but they want like some kind of something on paper, some law saying this will not happen. And that he's not going to get.
There was clearly some wiggle room in that answer. Tillis also seemed to be, as you said, on the warpath about what the weaponization of the Justice Department, not under Trump or Blanche or Pam Bondi, but under Biden and former Attorney General Merrick Garland.
What I've seen happening here is when we have a bad action of one administration, I'll be damned if we don't repeat it with the other one. I want leadership that says we're going to ratchet things down and not make the heinous mistakes that the Biden administration did. Let's be better than them. I'm not criticizing you, but I'm trying to just cut through the rhetoric and let people all know that we are at this place today in part because of the actions of the Biden administration and the weaponization that I even saw under Garland, who I generally supported.
Given the glacial speed at which Garland's Justice Department approached their investigations into the first Trump administration, what is he talking about?
Yeah, well, just because Tom Tillis says it very loudly and with a lot of passion doesn't mean it's not false equivalency, let's face it, because the people that from January 6th that were pardoned, this we're talking about, these are domestic folks, conspiracy and all of these things. And several of these people have gone on to commit more crimes, including crimes against children. So for him to say that is being so disingenuous. That's why I think that he will vote to put it forward because he really started attacking Democrats.
So let me turn to Ashley Fahey to lighten up this conversation. You can depend on her to help us lighten this up. A change is coming to license plates.
Wow.
Ashley. That's quite a segue.
That's quite a right turn. Yeah.
What is about to happen?
Yeah, basically, so in the budget, it's mandating the DMV basically figure out how to get all of our, what we normally get in the mail with our registration cards, the sticker we put on our plate every year, it's mandating that all go digital. It's a cost-saving measure, and folks are saying it's unnecessary now because a police officer can just instantly check a vehicle's registration status electronically. So essentially, these stickers are obsolete. If you want to get a actual physical card after October 1st, you will have to request that from the DMV and you will have to pay for it.
Do we know how Senator Tillis feels about this?
You can also download that and print it out yourself if you want a physical card. That's what happens people who don't have smartphones or don't want to deal with that on their smartphone. Cyclospora, a parasitic disease very quickly that can cause explosive diarrhea, is spreading across the country. Started in Michigan. It's now been traced to lettuce. It's also been traced to North Carolina, where about 200 or 300 cases have been exposed. How dangerous is this, Mary?
Well, you can get antibiotics for it, but it is like people say how unpleasant it is. Yes. There's a lot of things, the symptoms you don't really want to talk about in the morning, but it is tough and it can last for a while. So they're saying if you're having any symptoms, go to your doctor immediately. And we do see actually in North Carolina, there are a lot of cases in Wake and quite a few in Mecklenburg County also, but not quite as many. And there are, like I said, the latest news I was looking at this morning is they're tracing it to lettuce, which might be why I sauteed my lettuce before I had it yesterday.
Meanwhile, the historic Excelsior Club was torn down yesterday. I didn't know this was going to happen. I knew that a new developer had come in, bought the place, wanted to preserve it historically, and yet the wrecking ball met it yesterday. Why?
It is in just terrible shape and impossible to restore, and so they're going to build a replica, for lack of a better term.
And how does the community feel about that?
I think it's a mixed feelings. I mean, it's historic. As someone said, this is a little bit of history at the same time. And they want to make sure that they knew it was dangerous the way it is and it needs more parking and it's been sitting there for a decade crumbling. But, they want to make sure that its history is a designated historic site, is just remembered. And the developers say they're going to have a little museum. It's going to be community space, restaurant. But this is where, you know, in the 40s, segregated community, you could go, you could get there, you could gather. Folks like Nat King Cole, big acts used to go there. I remember when I first moved here, it was still there. People would gather to look at things like the inauguration of Barack Obama. You know, so people, I think, had mixed feelings about it. They want to make sure that the history of the Excelsior is preserved, not forgotten.
Meanwhile, Eric, meanwhile, Eric, PSLs are going the way of the dustbin, at least not for the Panthers.
Not for the Panthers, but if you're buying soccer season tickets, you no longer have to pay that one-time fee. Soccer fans are happy about that.
good Lord. They're going to lose money now. Actually, they think they're going to make money because that was an impediment to entry for some people. So maybe they'll have a larger attendance, which has been on the decline, believe it or not. Ashley Fay, Mary C. Curtis, Eric Spanberg, all with us this morning. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Our intern is Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte. Using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.